Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. We're recording this at 13 hours GMT on Monday, the 24th of April. The European Union tells Sudan's warring generals there can be no military solution to their power struggle and they must negotiate an end to the crisis. Climate activists have warned that China is fast expanding its network of coal-fired power plants. And Kenya's president has condemned a religious cult that encouraged people to starve themselves to death. Also in the podcast,
Charles has a problem with Gen Z. The future of the monarchy for Charles and for William and the popular support which they need is really in the balance when it comes to the younger people.
With his coronation less than 2 weeks away, how popular is King Charles in the UK? The scramble to flee the fighting in Sudan is continuing, with France and the US saying they are standing by to carry out more evacuations. As we record this podcast, South Africa has said it's currently carrying out an operation to rescue its citizens. Over the weekend, people from Europe, Africa and Asia were flown out of Sudan in military transport planes sent by a number of different governments. The EU foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, said more than 1,000 European citizens had reached safety.
So it has been a successful operation, but complex. It was in touch with the two generals fighting in Sudan. And now the ceasefire has stopped, it's over. We have to continue pushing for a political settlement. We cannot afford that Sudan, which is a very populated country, implodes because it will be sending shockwaves around the whole Africa.
Despite Mr. Borrell's reference to a ceasefire, most attempts at a truce between the army and the rival rapid support forces have failed. However, over the weekend, there does seem to have been a lull in the fighting as Saudi Arabia, the US and others launched their rescue operations. I heard more about the latest evacuations from our Africa correspondent, Andrew Harding.
There is an airbase just north of Khartoum that has been used and it seems will be continuing to be used for foreign military planes coming in to evacuate not just the diplomats now, but any other nationals from a range of countries, taking them mostly, it seems, to Djibouti on the Red Sea coast. There are also big overland convoys continuing to head towards the Red Sea port of Port Sudan, which is inside Sudan, and from where there are boats and planes that can get people out. We know there was a huge UN convoy that has been heading in that direction. We're waiting to hear more on that. One of the problems is that communications in the last 24 hours or so have really deteriorated. Phone lines, particularly the internet, cutting down. It's not clear if that's deliberate or it's simply because electricity supplies and so on are beginning to break up.
But despite the fact that those people have managed to get out and some are on the route to the borders, there must be millions still stuck in Khartoum with food and water running out.
Exactly. I mean, you spoke of a ceasefire. I think that's overstating what happened earlier yesterday to allow the Americans to bring in those helicopters to their compound near the River Nile. It was a lull. And since then, really, from what we're hearing of those convoys that have managed to get their way through the city and out to the outskirts and beyond, the fighting's still pretty intense. And both sides in this conflict are showing no interest in respecting this huge international pressure for many ceasefires and humanitarian corridors. We're not even at the stage where they're being pushed back towards the negotiating table. And that doesn't bode very well.
Does it need outside intervention to bring the two generals to the table?
We're looking more at pressure. The key question is, can it be concerted, uniform pressure on both these two generals? And will any funding, any armed supplies, petrol, financial supplies to either of these two military forces be curtailed so that the pressure is really strong to push them back to the negotiations?
Andrew Harding in Johannesburg. The UK said on Sunday that it had staged a, quote, complex and rapid operation to evacuate British diplomats and their families from Sudan. But some British nationals still there say they feel abandoned. One conservative-leaning newspaper here even called it a feeble response, with the British Foreign Office accused of failing to learn the lessons of the chaotic evacuation from Afghanistan in 2021. The BBC's Myeni Jones spoke to some of the British people left behind in Sudan.
Scary, very scary. And I think there's planes enjoying the fight.
British citizen Amar Osman lives in Edinburgh. He was visiting family in Omdurman, 15 miles north of the capital Khartoum, when the crisis started.
Heavy fighting just started now. And it is Sunday, 23rd.
Just an hour later, things intensified.
And it is now 6:30. And I think the fighting is round my street now. Very, very, very close. I'm going to have to go in.
Later that night, Amar and his wife Fatima told me they hadn't received any support from the Foreign Office since the crisis started.
I'm thinking we'll have to evacuate because things are getting really bad. It's frustrating. It's just...
Feel abandoned.
Yeah.
It's very traumatising here and the situation is really bad. It's getting worse. You see the clashes, the fighting, and everyone is trying just to escape and to flee the country. And you see that the country is really getting into a civil war.
Hundreds of foreigners have been evacuated from Sudan over the weekend. Saudi Arabia was the first country to pull its citizens out on Saturday. Since then, the US and the UK have airlifted their diplomats. France, Germany, Italy and others are organising evacuation missions. However, the UK currently doesn't have an evacuation plan for British nationals.
The Foreign Office are communicating as best they can. It's important that British nationals register.
Secretary of State for Defence, Ben Wallace.
And I'm working very closely with the Foreign and Commonwealth Office to see what else we can do to support them. But for now, they should follow the travel advice.
Myeni Jones reporting. Well, my colleague Michelle Hussain asked the British Minister for Development in Africa, Andrew Mitchell, what British nationals stuck in Sudan should do.
The advice essentially is to stay indoors and await further information. That has been our advice throughout all of this crisis, essentially. The answer to this crisis is a ceasefire, and Britain is working with all its international partners to try and secure that ceasefire. That is the key thing. Many of the humanitarian perpetrators are leaving. Some of them have been killed, as we know. So the situation is absolutely desperate, and a ceasefire is what is required. And the only advice that Britain can give to people is to stay indoors, because that is the safe option for
as
long as they can.
Why did you evacuate the diplomats and their families then?
Well, let me explain. That is the advice that we give to our citizens, but we are exploring every single possible way of getting them out. We've been in crisis mode, working 24/7 now for nearly a week, and we are focused on getting our citizens out. Now, you ask about the diplomats. The diplomats were in the most terrible position. The British Embassy and the residents were between the lines. They were in extreme jeopardy. There was fighting all around them. Other missions had been directly targeted. Some have been broken into. One of the diplomats had been held up at gunpoint. We took the decision that we had to get our diplomats out. They were in very great danger, and thanks to a highly complex but absolutely brilliantly executed operation by our troops, we got all of them bar one out yesterday, and the one who didn't get out is now in Djibouti. So that was a different category. We have a specific duty of care to our diplomats. We have a duty to all our citizens, of course, all around the world, but for diplomats and our own staff, we have a specific duty of care, and thank goodness we were able to exercise that fully yesterday morning.
But was it not possible to gather any other British citizens who might have been able to make it to the embassy and to evacuate them alongside the diplomats?
It wasn't. The situation on the ground was extremely complex, highly dangerous and difficult, and we are so grateful that we managed to get them all out without any casualties to our own forces. The British Embassy is now moving, relocating to Addis Ababa in the next door country, and British missions in all surrounding countries are there to receive any of our citizens who manage to get to the borders of those countries. We are doing everything we possibly can.
Andrew Mitchell, the British Minister for Development in Africa. Kenya's President William Ruto says the actions of a Christian cult suspected of encouraging mass suicides are akin to terrorism. Mr. Ruto was speaking as police exhumed more bodies of suspected cult followers who believed that if they starved themselves to death, they would go to heaven. Almost 60 people are now known to have died in the Shakahola forest in eastern Kenya. More than 100 others have been reported missing. Andrew Ocheng reports.
Officers dressed in white hazmat suits dig up a tented area of the Shakahola forest in Malindi on the Kenyan coast. On Sunday, they exhumed 18 more bodies. Many of those found in the shallow graves have been children. They're all believed to have been members of a cult called the Good News International Church, and their leader is accused of instructing them to starve to death in order to meet Jesus. Charities that have been helping say that even those who were rescued after others had died still refuse to receive help. Here's Khalid Hussein from Haki Africa.
Today we came across one individual who was rescued from the interior, but the moment she was brought here, she absolutely refused to be administered with first aid. And she closed her mouth firmly, basically refusing to be assisted, wanting to continue with her fast until she dies.
Kenya's security minister has ordered all the forest to be sealed off and declared a crime scene. More than 50 graves have been identified, and there are fears there could be more. One is believed to have contained the bodies of 5 family members, 3 children and their parents. One challenge in dealing with the issue is that suicide is considered a crime in Kenya, and some of those who have survived or have been rescued have been charged with attempting to take their own lives. Here's Khalid Hussein again.
These are victims. These are not criminals. We need psychosocial counselling so that they can be, de-radicalised and understand what is happening.
The leader of the cult, Pastor Mackenzie Nthenge, remains in police custody.
Andrew Ocheng reporting. 10 years ago today, we were reporting on the tragic collapse of a high-rise building in Bangladesh. The Rana Plaza complex had housed 5 factories making clothes for Western high street brands. More than 1,100 people died. Labour unions in Bangladesh have criticised the government for the slow pace of legal proceedings, including the trial of one owner accused of forcing employees to work in the building after a crack appeared. A decade on, this mother, Fadusi Begum, is still waiting for answers about her missing son.
My son's name is Nahidul Islam. He worked on the 5th floor. Even after 10 years, I've not found his body. Every year I come here in search of my son, but I don't find anything. I have a grandson. I can't answer questions about his father.
Well, our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etirajan, reported from the scene 10 years ago, and he told me about the continued anger of relatives and survivors.
Even today, hundreds of former government factory workers and their family members held their protest outside where the Rana Plaza was, demanding justice. Many of them had life-crippling injuries and they are still suffering from trauma. I was there in Dhaka 10 years ago. As soon as we heard about this incident, we rushed to the spot. Thousands of people outside that building around that time crying for their relatives and friends. The whole building came down, and for the next few days it was a harrowing experience for the families and friends, and that also opened the eyes of the outside world about the condition of the factory workers in Bangladesh, because Bangladesh has now emerged as the second biggest exporter of ready-made clothes to Western countries. If you go to any high street with a fashion brand like Primark or Marks & Spencer, they all source their clothes from Bangladesh, how these workers are living, what kind of wages they were being paid, and what conditions are these factories in. So that was really a watershed moment for Bangladesh's garments industry.
And what has changed since then?
Soon after this incident, many Western brands, particularly European brands, came together. They formed a group called Accord, and then many of the American brands started one called Alliance. These two initiatives, along with the trade unions and factory workers and the factory owners, the garments association in Bangladesh, they came together, pooled in money, and then they started inspecting thousands of factories in Bangladesh to improve the workplace, the safety conditions. The salary was also increased, and now it has gone up to $95, the minimum wage for a month. Previously, it was less than $40. So recommendations were made, and both the factory owners as well as the Western brands put in money. I went there even after 5 years to see how these security aspects were being improved. In the last 10 years, there have been no major incident, even though some people would question whether any of these outsourcing factories, whether they are following any rules and how they are being managed.
Our South Asia regional editor, Anbarsan Etirajan. US media reports say Joe Biden has chosen his campaign manager for next year's presidential election and is meeting advisers to discuss strategy. The senior White House correspondent for CBS News, Ed O'Keefe, says Mr. Biden will probably make the formal announcement this week.
Well, we're anticipating that it's going to happen on Tuesday with some kind of a video announcement, very common for politicians to do it that way these days. And it'll be some kind of summation about what he would like to still yet do should he win four more years. What I'm keen to know is whether he's going to mention perhaps the biggest barrier for him right now with voters that continues to show up in polling, and that is his age. How does he explain that? How does he justify being an 80-year-old man running for president, already the oldest U.S. president? Can he assuage the concerns, especially within his own party, which is a far younger party than Republicans, that he's up to the job, that he can literally survive it until the end of his second term? And what then does he say about what has been not yet accomplished by his team that he would like to get done? But otherwise, watch him tout the accomplishments of the last few years, restoring America's position in the world, fighting to sustain democracy in this country and around the world as well, and probably reminding voters that if it's not him, it's going to be a Republican, either Donald Trump or somebody like him, who would strip away a lot of the progress that he would argue has been made in the last several years.
Ed O'Keefe of CBS News. And still to come on the podcast, the results of the European Seagull Screeching Championship.
I think the most important thing is that you properly observe the birds and you really look at them carefully and you listen to them, because it takes exercise, it takes practice.
In 2008, 23-year-old Norwegian student Martine Vik Magnussen was killed in an apartment near Mayfair. Hours after her death, the only suspect in the case fled the UK to Yemen. He's never been questioned by the police. I'm Noelle El-Makhafi, and I made a promise to Martina's family 15 years ago to find out what happened. Murder in Mayfair. Part of the documentary. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Greenpeace says China's push for new coal-fired power plants risks climate disaster and could lock the world into a high-carbon future. Celia Hatton has this report.
China has promised to start cutting coal consumption by 2026. But in the meantime, local officials are under pressure to prevent power blackouts that have left millions without electricity at times when global coal prices are unstable. Greenpeace said China's local governments have approved more than 20 gigawatts of new coal power capacity in the first quarter of this year. That's more than was generated during the whole of 2021. It's a short-term solution. China has considerable renewable energy resources, and analysts say the country's needs can be met by upgrading the power grid to ensure wind and solar power are delivered to more customers.
Celia Hatton. Madagascar is battered by cyclones on a regular basis. Aside from the physical damage, these also put the island at heightened risk of disease. There have been several outbreaks of bubonic and pneumonic plague since 2014. In fact, three-quarters of all plague cases around the world occur in Madagascar. And scientists believe climate change is aggravating the situation. The BBC's Dorcas Wangira reports from Antananarivo.
On the northern edge of Madagascar's capital sits the sprawling slum of Ankasine. Children play near large puddles left after the night's heavy rains while their mothers gather around a public tap to draw water. Scientists from the Institut Pasteur's plague unit move through the community laying small rodent traps as they go.
It's a big man.
The plague is transmitted from rodents to human beings through the bite of an infected flea. After the traps are filled, they'll travel back to a lab where the head of the unit, Dr. Minori Suarejason, and her team will run tests to better understand how zoonotic diseases are spreading here.
Madagascar plague is mainly a rural disease. It's related to activity linked with agriculture. Most of people sleep on the ground. There's a risk for a contact also with rats.
In Nkarikele Lafi, a quiet rural area, not too far from the city, lives Narina, a plague survivor whose name has been changed to protect her identity. The mother of three is still reeling from the deaths of her husband, brother-in-law and sister-in-law to the plague in the space of 1 month earlier this year. With little education or awareness about the disease here, a shroud of stigma surrounds those infected.
My husband's family don't believe that it's the plague that killed their relatives. They believe that it's poisoning. My father-in-law told me, "You killed my son. We don't need you anymore. Leave us."
The most common symptom of the bubonic plague is swollen lymph nodes. Even treated, it can advance to the lungs and becomes pneumonic. Direct or close contact with an infected person can easily transmit the disease. The plague kills about 1 in 10 patients who are infected. However, it's easy to treat with antibiotics if detected early. The latest IPCC report warned that every increment of warming results in rapidly escalating hazards, increasing risks for human health. Zora Kotomavo, a meteorologist at Meteo Madagascar, agrees.
The more it is hot, the more it is favorable for multiplication of flea bringing plague. And climate-sensitive disease like malaria and plague can appear in regions who have usually or historically never experienced that.
Madagascan meteorologist Zoe Rakotomavo ending that report from Dorcas Wangira. A new series begins on BBC Radio today, exploring the extraordinary resilience of the men, women and children who were herded into the prison within a city known as the Warsaw Ghetto. It is 80 years since the Warsaw Ghetto uprising, an act of resistance that led to a mass slaughter by the Nazis of as many as 13,000 people. It's a story that has survived from the Second World War to the modern age because of an organised effort to write accounts of what life was like.
It seems to me that I have not the right, but the duty to live, because the memory of those who were killed lives in me, and so does the tragedy of their doom. I sometimes feel like a pregnant woman who worries and frets about the fetus growing in her womb. But unlike a pregnant woman, I am preoccupied not with the future life that I bear, but the past life which has died, and whose reflection, whose luminous shadow, I wish to preserve in human consciousness.
Tracy Ann Oberman as Rachel Auerbach. Well, the actor's family were also in the Warsaw Ghetto, and she spoke to Justin Webb.
Rachel ran the kitchen in the Warsaw Ghetto. I say kitchen, they had no food, so they did as best that they could. And she was one of the main writers for Mr. Ringelblum's project Oneg Shabbat, which was about writing in real time everything that was happening in the ghetto, every single moment. He tried to get as many people as he could, children, rabbis, ordinary people, to write about their experiences in the ghetto, to have a testimony that would happen, hopefully, if any of them survived, to tell the world what had actually happened in the Warsaw Ghetto.
Did Rachel survive?
Yes, she was one of three people of the Oneg Shabbat group who did survive, and she oversaw when it was raised after they had deported all the Jews to Treblinka and other concentration camps. Rachel actually had managed to escape, but they had buried all of the writings that they could before the Warsaw Ghetto was razed to the ground. And they buried it under the kitchen in metal boxes. And she went back after the war and oversaw the recovery of whatever they could of the testimonies.
Yeah. It is an extraordinary story, isn't it? I mean, for all that the story has been told before, the fact of having the contemporaneous jottings of people.
Exactly.
I mean, presumably it's, what is it, a mix of sort of what's actually going on in daily life, but also other wider thoughts about what has happened, about what the future might be?
Yes, I mean, in Rachel's testimonies that I read, she you know, writes about the mundanities of running a kitchen for the entire ghetto with no food and just rotten vegetables that were bought in. And she talks about finding little children looking like starved rats hiding behind, a barrel that they had of some rotten cabbage, and these children were stuffing their faces. She talks about people lying outside the kitchen, you know, sort of dying. She talks about the bodies. She talks about how do you cook for however many people with just hot water and sort of rotten onions. And she also talks about, you know, philosophically about what it's like to see your people being absolutely decimated and wiped out. She was an amazing woman. She wrote beautifully. She was passionate about keeping these testimonies alive. She tried to be as dispassionate as she could, but there's a couple of pieces that I read that are heartbreaking, really heartbreaking.
Tracy Ann Oberman, and part one of The Warsaw Ghetto: History as Survival begins today and is available on BBC Sounds. The coronation of King Charles III in 12 days' time has fuelled debate on the future of the British monarchy. Should the head of state still inherit the position because of the family they were born into, as has been the case for centuries? Or should the UK switch to an elected system? A survey for the BBC suggests that although many people still support the monarchy, there's been a big fall in its popularity, particularly among young people, over the past decade. Jane Corbyn has the details.
So the YouGov poll of nearly 4,600 UK adults suggests that 58% want the monarchy to continue, and just a quarter want an elected head of state instead. But when YouGov asked the same question in July 2013, a year after Queen Elizabeth's Diamond Jubilee, support was at a high at 75% of British people polled then. They said the monarchy should continue. And since then, it's been drifting downwards. In both polls, young people were least likely to support the monarchy. But in our recent poll, carried out just over a week ago, less than a third of 18 to 24-year-olds said the monarchy should continue, compared with nearly two-thirds in 2013. So that's halved. I spoke to Professor Anna Whitelock of City University in London, and she's a historian exploring the place of the monarchy in modern Britain.
Charles has a problem with Gen Z. The future of the monarchy for Charles and for William, and the popular support which they need, is really in the balance when it comes to the younger people.
In our poll, we asked if people think the royal family has a problem with race and diversity. 46% say it doesn't. 32% says it does. But among those from an ethnic minority background, far more, almost half, think the royals have a problem with race and diversity. Some people may have been alienated by what happened with Prince Harry and Meghan. The marriage, it was hoped, would create a more diverse, inclusive royal family. But during the Oprah Winfrey interview, Meghan claimed that questions were asked by one of the royals about the likely skin colour of the couple's unborn child. The royal family denied any racism. Buckingham Palace say His Majesty and the royal household treat all matters of race and diversity with great seriousness.
Jane Corbyn reporting. Now, did you know there is an entire competition dedicated to humans trying to emulate that sound? It's called the European Seagull Screeching Championship, and it happened over the weekend in Belgium, as David Lewis reports.
Pop in for a coffee or chips to this Belgian cafe on Sunday, and you might well overhear these sounds. But don't be fooled. Those aren't seabirds. They're humans doing their best turn. The concept is the brainchild of comedian Claude Villette, who also works in a nearby coastal visitor centre. He wants to challenge the often negative impression humans have of the birds and have a laugh doing it too. So what exactly do you have to do? Well, simply put, get up on stage and screech and behave like you're one of the seagulls. There's a jury of five, each a gull lover, the organisers assure us, who'll judge both the bird calls and avian acting, and then crown a European champion. And it's not just Belgians taking part. There are participants from the Netherlands, France and Italy too. A Canadian entrant adds to the international flavour as well. So what tips to win? Well, one jury member, Jan Says, told the BBC, you're going to have to put the work in.
I think the most important thing is that you properly observe the birds and you really look at them carefully and you listen to them, because it takes exercise, it takes practice. I've tried it many times under the shower and for me it doesn't work, but there are people, like last year there were participants who performed so well that I could not distinguish between a natural sound and the one they produce.
Anyone is welcome to sign up and screech. Everybody dreams of becoming a champion, event organisers say. Try it out and you will see the audience adores it. But first, practice and practice, they add.
David Lewis. Well, one person who must have practiced was the winner, 21-year-old Dutchman Jarmo Slutter, with this sound. Jarmo Slutter. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was produced by Alice Adderley and mixed by Ethan Connolly Forster. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
Fifteen years ago, 23-year-old Norwegian student Martine Vik Magnussen was killed in an apartment near Mayfair.
Den norske studenten Martine Vik Magnussen.
23-year-old Martine Vik Magnussen was found partially buried in the basement.
Police investigating the murder of a Norwegian socialite in central London.
Her body was found in the building where the only suspect was living, Farouk Abdelhak, the son of one of the Middle East's richest and most powerful men. Before being questioned, Farouk fled from the UK to Yemen, where he's been ever since. I'm Noelle El-Makhafi. I made a promise to Martina's family over a decade ago to find out what happened and do what no journalist nor the police have been able to do until now. Find Farouk. Murder in Mayfair. Listen to the whole story now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.